Good.
I told one of the groups today when we spoke in the afternoon. I want to repeat it to everyone here, that you get special brownie points.
What are brownie points in Hebrew?
Belohnungspunkte im Schulheft. Goldene Sterne.
Kuchavit.
Merits. So you get brownie points, Kuchavit.
Merits.
Lots of merits for coming here at this time. It's not an easy time to be here, as you, I'm sure, are aware of. Sometimes we are motivated in our practice by instant gratification. So we say we want to practice meditation, but actually what we want to practice is feeling good. This is very common. This is very normal. In fact, trying to feel good is the healthy version of this issue. Much of our growth, much of our development is stimulated by trying to feel good. So I don't want to be down on the attempt of trying to feel good. Yeah. Psychologically, this is very healthy. Yeah. Problem is, it doesn't work. Yeah. So psychology is quite eager to admit that capacity to live with delayed gratification is generally rated as a sign of maturity. So even psychology admits that the attempt to feel good doesn't always work. So even psychology, not just religions, religions are famous for that, but psychology as well, tries to pretend that some things you need to do now and they don't feel good, and the good comes later. Yeah. That's what religion usually is famous for saying. You know, you behave down here on earth and then you go to heaven and then things will be well, or, you know. Right now it's tough, but then the Mashiach comes and then things will be better or something like that. Yeah, there's many versions of this. Buddhist version of this is, yeah, this is a, samsara is really difficult business, but then Maitreya Buddha comes and then you go, or you go to Amitabha Buddha in the blue paradise, Western paradise, and then things will be better. Yeah. You're making merit now. So this is what I'm doing to you. I'm doing the Buddhist version of this. I'm saying you're doing merit by coming here under difficult conditions. When we learn to practice under difficult conditions, the fruit will be sweet. Yeah. But, you know, sometimes it takes a lot of growth till the fruit come out. You know, you have many months, no fruit. I'm serious. I may not look it, but I am serious. When we meditate, it is important to understand that you basically, you are farmers. You're cultivators. Yeah. That's the Chinese name for meditator, is cultivator. I told you yesterday the term meditation is a very strange term for Buddhist practice called bhavana, bringing into being, or the other word would be cultivation. Truly we are cultivators, so we plant seeds. But sometimes between the seed planted and even seeing something sprouting, can take quite some time. You know, depending which seed you plant, and you can wait quite a long time. So meditation is planting seeds and watering the seeds and keeping off the snails when the seeds are sprouting and making sure that the stems are growing up straight by putting in a stalk and keeping off more snails and protecting against the sun. And carrying water when it's really getting hot. And bringing nourishment when it's already growing quite nicely. And holding back your hands when you're trying to eat the fruit too early. Yeah. So, meditation is all of these things. It's not just feeling good. Some of these activities feel good when you do them. Some of them don't. So do not mistake. The value of your practice and the immediate state you're experiencing. Do not necessarily do not mistake these things. Things can be healthy and good for you and very, very effective, even though they don't feel good. I said it in one of my groups. If your mind is wandering, as I would expect your minds to be wandering, that's what healthy minds are doing. They wander. It's a function of the human mind to think. The Buddha quite clearly acknowledged this. He said, what you feel that you perceive, what you perceive that you evaluate in terms of pleasure and displeasure, what you evaluate in terms of pleasure and displeasure, that you will have thoughts about. What you have thoughts about, this will haunt you in terms of thinking and obsession. So there's very early on in Buddhist teaching an acknowledgement that it is the natural process of the mind not just to experience sensorially by hearing, seeing, tasting, touching, smelling, but also by producing cognitive processes by which we arrive at concepts, by which we arrive at percepts to start with, and by which we arrive at finally at thought. This is right there in Buddhist teaching. There is an acknowledgement that this is what a mind does. So the problem is not that the mind does do these things, even though some of these thoughts are of questionable value if you look at what you think during a day of meditation, isn't it? Sometimes it can come, the suspicion can grow upon one that this is not actually very effective nor very useful. And often enough, it's not much fun either. So one does wonder where all these thoughts come from and what keeps the thinking process going. So maybe we need to investigate this further on some other occasion. But indeed, the problem is not that this happens. The problem is what relationship we take to the thought, to the content of our thought. And yet again, meditation boils down to something like, how do I relate to my experience? When I said yesterday that the four Brahma Viharas are relational qualities, that they are the practices for the human realm. The four Brahma Viharas, even Upekkha, which sounds like I'm not so connected to others, even Upekkha is a relational quality. When we investigate how sati works, how mindfulness works, when we find out, how I described this morning metta to be functioning in terms of psychological steps, all this is about relating. Yeah. All this is about relating. So my relationship to thought, my relationship to other people, my relationship to my self-construct, my relationship to any event in my experience boils down to my capacity to relate, to my resonance to be able to relate, to my attentional focus in which I relate, to my willingness to relate, to my capacity to stay in relationship. All this has something to do with relationship. You begin to suspect, you begin to smell the rat, isn't it? All this meditation business is not about being saintly looking, sitting on your cushion alone on your mat, and not having any connection to the world or getting away from the world. It is about more profoundly connecting with this world. It is about more profoundly connecting with other people, but more profoundly connecting with parts of yourself that maybe you wish not to connect. Buddhist psychology operates, I'm speaking now from the Buddhist psychology that is based on the early sutta teachings. The truth is there are many Buddhist psychologies, like there are many Western psychologies, and Buddhist psychologists seem to be more in agreement with each other than what I have understood of Western psychologies. Almost all Buddhist traditions agree that self is a fiction. While if you ask any two different Western psychological schools, they cannot agree what a self is, what it constitutes, how useful it is, how to find it, how to fix it. Buddhist psychologists, although there are many more than we tend to admit when we speak, Buddhism says, or the Buddha says, there tends to be a consensus that self is a fiction. It's a fiction to make us feel better, and it doesn't work. And like so many things that try to make us feel better, it turns out that the thing that was going to make us feel better is actually becomes the main problem. It's like, you start drinking because your life is so boring, and if you drink long enough, you know, your life won't be boring anymore because you now have not the problem of boredom anymore, you have a problem called alcoholism. So self is a little bit like that. Initially, it comes about because it makes things more safe. You know, it feels, if we have a self, things are a little more solid and stable. We know what we're called and where we belong and what's ours and what's not. And this is developmentally quite useful. But after a while, the self becomes actually an issue because the self is very wobbly. It's not very stable. Turns out it needs a lot of maintenance. Yeah. It's a leaky boat, that self. Yeah. And you need to kind of haul water. If you want to stay afloat with a leaky boat, you need to keep hauling water. And initially you said, okay, we take this bad boat. It maybe takes us somewhere good. And you think that the self actually gets you somewhere. And then you find out that it doesn't get you anywhere, but it takes all your efforts to keep afloat. You need to keep patching it up. You need to be fixing it. It's very difficult to make something happen that actually doesn't exist, that is a fiction. But once we have gotten used to having a self, and being a self, and identifying with a self, and keeping a self satisfied and validated and reassured and having it compete with other selves, you know, once we've got engaged in this process, it's very difficult to get out of this. So usually we don't like getting out of it. We feel lonely. We feel disoriented. We feel lost. We're back in the sort of feelings we didn't want to have in the first place. Usually they're called things like uncertainty, not knowing, ambiguity, all the stuff we don't handle well. It's the stuff we don't handle well. We're pretty good at handling challenges as human beings. We're pretty good at handling adversity. We can be very resourceful. We've survived on this planet for a long time under very difficult circumstances. Some of us live in the Sahara and some of us live up on the Arctic Circle. Somehow we've managed. We've managed to adjust just about every aspect of our lives. Food, procreation, movement, what we do, how we stay healthy. You ever found out there's no two systems of dietary understanding that tell us what is good for human beings? Some people live on rotten seals and fish and things like that, and other people live on yogurt and dried apricot. And somehow human beings seem capable of adapting to both, isn't it? Isn't surprising. So, adversity, change, challenges, saber-toothed tigers, parking problems, all this stuff we cope quite well. Yeah. Hostile governments, all this stuff we cope quite well. What we really don't cope very well psychologically is not knowing, uncertainty, meaninglessness. That's what we're really bad at. It has to make sense. Once it makes sense, we put up with a lot. We're quite good at putting up with suffering when it makes sense. So much of our skill is creating meaning. Much of our skill is creating relationship and creating learning situations. The center of our experience, Buddhist psychology calls citta. The earliest Buddhist psychology uses that term in quite contradictory ways. Sometimes the citta is described as something very fleeting, fast. It is described as an animal that moves very fast, changes very fast. Sometimes the citta is described as the hub of our experience. It is described as the habitat of my heart. The citta is described as something before the mind, as in intellect, and before the heart, as in emotional seat of my experience, is separated. So it seems that the Buddha in his early days, we're speaking here of the 4th century BC, for Jewish people this is already quite late, you know. For Buddhists this is quite early, 4th century BC also. The citta is where I go to when I'm being asked how I feel. The citta is a place that changes constantly, and yet it feels as if it is coherent. The citta is not myself. If I make a self out of the citta, I'm in trouble. It's going to hurt. Trouble always means pain in Buddhism. If you do things wrong in Buddhism, it always hurts. So Buddhists speak a lot about understanding properly and the danger of ignorance and not knowing and misapprehension and distortion. What they really mean is it hurts. When I don't understand, it hurts. When I mistake, it hurts. When I'm not interested in learning, it hurts. This is what Buddhism is, very simple. Not getting it means it's painful. And the really bad thing is that Buddhists think this is good. This is what makes us learn. The Buddha is quite blunt. It says, three things. If there were three things not, there would be no spiritual path. What are these three things? Now you would think samatha, vipassana, and maybe faith or something like that. But no. It's old age, sickness, death. Yeah. Buddhists are realistic people. They know we're not really interested in learning unless it hurts. Yeah. Sometimes we are playfully curious and we have fun and we understand things. But really good learning mostly takes place if I have some pressure, if I need to understand, if something hurts, if I am in need, if I'm in trouble, if I experience discomfort. Strangely, the Buddha nowhere says you only can learn from pain. According to Buddhism, it would be quite possible to learn also from happiness. It just so seems that anecdotal evidence, I don't want to really claim this completely scientifically, but anecdotal evidence seems to say that we don't learn when we're happy. We're not very creative when we're happy. We're not very interested in challenging our concepts. We're not really profoundly investigating. When the sky is blue, the sun is shining, the river's full of fishes, and the fruit are full of trees. The trees are full of fruit, yeah? So the citta, when afflicted by a condition called dukkha, becomes, on one level, it becomes shrunk, it contracts. On another level, it becomes capable of profound understanding. So growth does not take place when I stop suffering. Growth, according to Buddhist psychology, takes place when I learn to suffer in useful ways. When I learn to suffer elegantly. Really beautifully elegant suffering. When I learn to suffer with economy. Yeah. Only a little bit of suffering and a lot of learning. Yeah. So, in Buddhist understanding, it takes some type of friction for us to stimulate growth. Just enough friction that we go into the growth zone of development. If the friction is too big, we get overwhelmed. We tend to regress and contract and go back to very simple things. Things like, I don't want to know. It hurts. You can't do this to me. I get angry and then everybody is afraid of me and then I get what I want. Those would be very simple structures. Yeah. So if things are really too bad, we go into this kind of regressed mode. We become very childlike. If we are meeting the suffering we experience in our lives and the frustration and the dissatisfaction and the discontent and the meaninglessness and the disappointments and many other things which are called suffering in Buddhism, when we meet this with a quality of awareness, then something else can start happening, then learning start happening. So the question is not, how little suffering can I get? It's more the opposite. How much can I take? Yeah. And the place where this takes place is in the citta. Now that citta is capable of great intuitions in Buddhist teaching. The Buddha is quite clear. It says the citta, when bright and when stabilized, the citta is capable of immense intuition. It is able of completely understanding the nature of the mind and the nature of experience. That's the key to liberation. Understanding mind and understanding experience. The citta is luminous. It is knowing. It is capable of brahma-viharas. These brahma-viharas take place in the citta. It is capable of samadhi, deep, profound, nourishing stillness. The citta is capable of penetrative insights. The only thing in Buddhism that releases us from suffering is understanding. It's not willpower, or it's not God's grace, or it's not logic, or it's not extrasensory powers to dissociate from your experience. The only thing that really makes the heart free is understanding how things work. And once we understand how things work, we stop trying to be happy in ways that don't work, and we're trying to be happy in ways that do work. So the citta is capable of such profound understanding. When it is in a good shape, then this citta can wake up. It can be completely freed. It can experience citta vimutti. It can experience apamanyas. It can experience profound insight into suchness, into emptiness, into conditionality, into interconnectedness, that thing. Unfortunately, the citta isn't always luminous and bright. Sometimes it's tired, or grumpy, or ignorant, or disinterested, or sometimes it's in pain. So the citta is easily seduced. And when it is seduced, it gets a little bit distorted, it gets warped, and its capacity to understand clearly is impaired, significantly impaired. So much so that things can look the opposite of what they are. The Abhidhamma teaching, which is a stratum of Buddhist texts, an attempt to systematize the teachings of the Buddha. It postdates the Buddha a few centuries, probably started already in his lifetime, but the actual systematization of the Abhidhamma is considerably later. The Abhidhamma tries to define the citta slightly differently, and explains that the citta is only one moment, one mind moment, one impulse in the mind. If we're looking at the earliest part of Buddhist teaching, this doesn't really seem to be the case. The citta is the seat of our experience. It's literally at the heart of my experience. Every aspect of that citta, its will functions, its perceptions, its feeling tone, its emotions, the whole climate of affect, all this changes in there. There's nothing solid. And yet it feels it's coherent. It feels as if there's somebody in here who experiences the world out there. Why this is the case, we would have to spend some more time together. That's a little more complicated. For tonight, let's just assume that the citta is the place where I receive the world through my senses. And in that place, the world that comes through six different senses, Buddhist psychology operates with six senses, the five outer senses, and the mind is also a sense function, a sense organ, where these six different senses coalesce into an experience of me and world. Yeah? And the split between me and world is part of the problem. Because that split takes place, I feel isolated from the world. I look to that world to give me things to make me feel good, or to stay away from me because it makes me afraid. The coloring this process produces in the citta are called states, mind states. Now, the more of those states take place, the less the citta is capable of actually doing its major job, namely understanding. If you want, the suttas speak of three layers of the function of a citta. The first layer is basic sensitivity, rudimentary sensory activity, and receiving this. This is pretty important. If we're not sensitive, we are in a profound way ignorant. Ignorance, the demon in Buddhism, if you want. Not knowing on an energetic level means lack of sensitivity. I am just not sensitive to something. So the fundamental function of the citta is receiving sense impressions. The next layer of the citta is processing sense impression, usually with reactions. This is good, this is not good. I want this, I want more of this, this is not enough. Can I have less of this, please? Yeah. This makes me feel happy, this makes me feel sad. This is meaningless to me. This makes me angry. This is really vitalizing to me. This is the most meaningful to me. Yeah. This is the sort of layer we're speaking. Yeah. It's the response of our self-construct, our bodies, to the sensory impact, impingements we get. And the third function of the citta is very simple. It's to understand. Now, it's no secret that that third function of understanding is a lot more effective when the other two functions are not very strong. The more the citta is preoccupied with receiving sense impressions, the less it is capable of understanding. Now that's counterintuitive, isn't it? Usually we would expect the more I get in, the more I know about the world. The more information I can, the more data I can process, the more I actually know. Buddhist teaching says no, this is not the case. It just clogs up the channels. By getting in more stuff, the reactions of the citta are stronger, and the energy it takes to process the sensory input preoccupy the energies of the citta so that there isn't really much space left to understand. So if we want to heighten the understanding function of the citta, we need to scale down the sensory input, and we need to down-modulate the emotional and volitional responses to the world. Yeah? We need to play down the two other functions of the citta. This is where meditation comes in. Meditation clearly favors stillness, favors stability, favors low threshold intensities. And what happens when we do this for a while, we learn to see things more clearly. This act of seeing things more clearly is directly due to an increased performance of the third function of the citta. Now the citta is sometimes described as a radiant full moon. A moon that completely reflects what is. The light of the sun hitting the full moon and the cool brightness of a full moon has always inspired Indian traditions to see in the full moon, the cool light of the full moon, a profound aspect of wisdom. Not all traditions have it understood that way. Astrology doesn't quite understand it that way. You know? The moon stands for something else. In the iconography, you know, from early descriptions in the Pali texts, right down to Tibetan tankas, you see the full moon standing as a symbol for awakening. Some of the tankas, if you have ever seen the Wheel of Becoming, big tanka where the Buddha outlines the 12 links of dependent arising and the six realms and the three poisons of mind and the rising beings and descending beings, where he outlines all this, you see generally the outside of this whole wheel, in the right-hand corner, usually there is a Buddha statue, and the Buddha statue points over to the left-hand corner where there is a full moon. Yeah. So the Buddha outside, the wheel of becoming, stands there and points to the possibility of awakening. Yeah, that would be a good example of the role of the full moon in early iconography. So the citta sometimes is clear, still, radiant, capable of profound understanding, and obviously with that understanding becomes liberated. But then there are factors that trouble the citta. One of them is just intensity of sense input. Another is emotional uproar. If we are emotionally distraught, if we're emotionally in very powerful states, the citta is not very clear. It cannot understand. It has strong feelings of intensity. This can feel quite meaningful or quite urgent, but we are not really profoundly seeing with such a state. Yeah. So meditative traditions have always tried to find out how can we make the citta more bright? How can we favor the understanding function at the expense of the other two functions? How can we create a situation in which the mind does not have to process so much stuff, so much thoughts, so much sensory input, so much emotions, so that the citta can rest in itself? The image is very simple. Think of a glass of water mixed with sand, and then you swirl this a little bit, you shake it a little bit, and the water and the sand mix and make a very cloudy sort of mass in that glass. Now, you place that glass for a moment, and the swirling gradually stops, and the sand will sink down, and the water will become clear again. This is what happens to the mind. Because mind and the objects of mind, which is all the sense data, all the thoughts, all the moods, all the images, all the impulses, these are all objects of mind. Mind and mind objects are separate. So if you let the mind still for a mile and do not feed it any further and do not shake it anymore, just sit still with it and willing to bear with the murky mass in it. This is what you're doing when you meditate. Yeah, you recognize it? When you do that for a while, it becomes clear. Yeah, that's the message. So you don't need to do many more things. Only not feed it, not shake it, and wait. That's the beauty of it. Now, most people don't have enough time to wait. They say, oh, this is boring. Yeah? Isn't there something else? Yeah, I like this Buddhism stuff. I like meditation, but only half an hour today. Then I want to go football. Yeah, sorry, Buddhism. I don't have much time for you. Say what you have to say, and then, you know, if it doesn't work, half an hour, I'm off. Yeah, I've got more important things to do than being free, being happy, getting awake, and so forth. Yeah. I have a busy life to live. Yeah. So you understand why meditation is not popular, because it doesn't immediately gratify. It says, do things and then wait. It's like planting things. Yeah. You dig things, you put things into the earth, and then you wait. You wait a long time. Days. Yeah. Maybe weeks till something comes out. And when it starts coming out, you don't pull at it. Yeah. You don't go and say, oh, great, I help it. Yeah. Doesn't work like that. You say, ooh, wonderful. We give some water. We make sure it's turned into the sun. We make sure no insects go into it. So that waiting is necessary. That takes maturity. And it takes some cultivation. And you know what you cultivate? You cultivate relationship. That's what you do. Basically, cultivation means cultivating relationships. So you cultivate relationships. Some of the things you cultivate relationships to are things you like. Yeah? They feel good. And some of the things don't. Some of the things are not even there. You need to basically invent them. If you want to practice patience, it's a great Buddhist virtue. If you want to practice patience, you can only practice patience when you're willing to bear with impatience. Yeah? You can't practice patience in the dry. Yeah? I do some reserve patience practice right now. It feels good to have some energy. I just do some patience practice. That's not when you practice patience. You practice patience with the experience of impatience. Yeah? So all this happens in the citta. And I tell you this because it is important to understand that there are many factors in the citta which help. And sometimes it feels like we're not making progress. It feels like we're not getting ahead. It feels like we're not moving on. This is understandable because we're impatient. We're used to fairly linear processes. Yeah, I do something, I count to 1, 2, 3, and then something happens, and I get it, and wonderful. Well, don't get it, I do something else. But something takes longer. I'm sure human beings have taken some time to figure out that, you know, there are things you do in autumn under the blanket, and suddenly next spring you get a baby. You know, I'm sure this has taken some time to figure out there is a causal connection between the things you do under the blanket and the baby's getting born a few months later. It wasn't obvious in the first place. It seemed to be two different things. Sometimes the human mind just want to deny causality. The sugar I put in my tea and the bill my dentist sends me have nothing to do with each other. Totally different thing. You know, one tastes sweet and one tastes bitter. There's no connection there. So sometimes it takes a moment to actually connect the dots between cause and effect, or conditions and result. So the same happens in meditation. Sometimes I've seen so many people starting to meditate, and you know, some people, they immediately get very still minds. And think, oh wow, it didn't take me long. That was good. I think I'm better than the Buddha. Buddha took 6 years to get enlightened. I'm already done, you know, after one short weekend retreat. Yeah. And some people just get pain, yeah? Or sleepiness, or horrible thoughts coming up in their mind. And you know, in the long run, it's not important whether you started off with good samadhi or with knee pain, neurotic thinking, and, you know, upset stomach. In the long run, it's not important how it started. In the long run, it's important that you stick with it, that you stay in relationship. Now, what are the things that make me stay in relationship? That's a good question. What is the nourishing factor in my practice? Buddhist tradition speaks of 5 things. They're very easily named. Faith, or trust, more precisely. A quality called satta, coming from the heart. The heart is in there. Hardaya, hadaya is in there, the word. It's a quality of the heart. It's not a quality of belief. Faith is when you don't when you don't need any more beliefs, okay? When you can trust without being in need of beliefs anymore. Okay? This is a source for strength and energy in Buddhist practice. The next one is energy itself, virya, the capacity to engender mentally and physically effort, yeah? And the willingness to apply yourself. That's the yoga we spoke of. The willingness to put on a yoke and start dragging your cart, yeah? Start dragging your vehicle. The third one is easy. This is sati. The fourth one is stillness of mind. This is samadhi. If you want to help me eradicate the word concentration, this may be a good moment to point it out. Try not to think of samadhi as concentration. Try thinking of samadhi as unification, calm, stillness. It's something that the mind likes doing. And it's something that the mind, if you let it, and if you help it, does on its own. Concentration sounds like you can do it. Yeah. You can do it with will. What you can do with will is you can pull back your attention from one thing and put it onto another thing. That's what you can do with will. Yeah. If you don't do your homework and your dad comes and says, you know, concentrate yourself, then this is what he means. Stop daydreaming and focus on your arithmetic exercises. That is not what the Buddha means when he speaks of samadhi. This is an attentional technique. It's useful, but it doesn't really give deep insight. It doesn't feel very peaceful. It's not sustainable. And it's not profoundly unifying. So let's be clear. When the Buddha speaks of samadhi, he speaks of a profound depth of the mind and something that comes together. The image is the image of water. It's cohesive, the cohesiveness of mind. Now, this is not something you can do with will. What you can do is you can give your mind tasks that make it more likely that this unification of mind takes place. The quickest way to produce that unification of mind is called letting go. If you want samadhi, there's two things very powerful. One of them, the really powerful one, is letting go. Let go of things that make the mind agitated. Let go of control. Let go of desire. Let go of aversion. Let go of trying to have a say in everything. Let go of knowing everything. Let go of commenting everything. Let go of tearing everybody who is wrong. Letting go of all these things. Letting go of telling yourself who you are. That's maybe the biggest one. So letting go is a direct tool to make the mind unified. But the other big tool to making the mind unified is metta. It's Brahma, the Brahma Vihara called metta. Friendliness. It's no secret that the people who have good samadhi also generally have easy access to metta practice, have easy access to a mind that is friendly and welcoming and full of wholesome, warm intentions. A mind that is capable of connecting with well-being. So, these two factors, the letting go and the quality of engendering metta, are the things that bring about samadhi. More than concentration, more than will. The last of the factors that nourishes spiritual practice is wisdom. Yeah. So. Now you have two pairs. The pair of faith and the pair of wisdom, they should be in balance. If you have too much faith, you get a little blue-eyed. Good climbing.
Naivere.
Emuna.
Blind faith.
Yeah. I mean naive, actually. I don't mean blind faith. Okay. So, too much faith and not enough wisdom will make you gullible and blue-eyed and things like that, yeah? The result is blind faith. Perfectly correct. The naivety is the forerunner of the blind faith. So too much wisdom and not enough faith makes you cynical. You know everything and you don't do anything. Western society has brought a whole brand of creatures about that are good at this. They're kind of intellectual experts. They know the problem so well and they can't fix it. But they can tell you. They can tell you exactly what went wrong. The German poet Brecht had a particular contempt for such people, and in one of his descriptions he describes them, he calls them tuis. And he describes them and he says, tuis, these are creatures that stand with very, very long fingers in front of the bakery shop and they show the hungry people how the bread is called. And explain to the hungry people everything about bread. And point with the long, pointy fingers, point to the bread behind the glass. So, too much panya and not enough faith makes us imbalanced in the way that we cannot connect our understanding with a heartful, stout-hearted response, neither in terms of compassion nor in terms of engendering goodness. The other pair in there is the pair of energy, virya, and the pair of samadhi. If you have too much samadhi, then everything is quiet. Again, you don't do much. There's a certain, I wouldn't say sleepiness, but it's a quietude that does not translate deeply into life. It's just me and my little peace behind my little candle, behind my little garden, and everything is fine. It's a bit bourgeois. It's a kind of, okay, it's peaceful here, but I don't care. As long as it's peaceful here with me, outside I don't really care so much. Historically, sometimes meditators have been accused of this. Meditators have been accused of many things, but this has been an accusation that they don't really change things, that they don't really help, that they don't really engage, that they move away from people, from society, on which they depend, by the way, and then they don't feed anything back. Most of the time, I don't think this has actually been very true. Meditators are a very marginal group of people. If you look in terms of religious activity, then meditating is a very small segment of religious activity. Even in Buddhist religion, most Buddhists don't meditate. In fact, most Buddhist monks don't meditate, as you probably know. So, I think the accusation that meditators are holding back progress in society has not been very just. The other story, which is much more common, is not enough meditation, not enough stillness, and too much energy brings about the restless activism. It's very unpeaceful. So, wisdom and faith, stillness and energy are supposed to be in balance. Sati, as the fifth one, or the one in the middle, you can never have enough of. The Buddha says you can never have enough of mindfulness. Mindfulness is useful and appropriate under all circumstances. So if you look for nourishing relationship, if you think of practicing meditation as relationship to your own experience, then these would be the four or the five grounds for nourishment. If you forget everything I said tonight, don't forget, please, metta as the path to make the mind still. Learning to be with your mind and to understand how your mind functions on the basis of relating to your mind. How it is, not how it should be, or how you like it to be, or how you think you deserve it to have. But relating to how it is now. Can I be a friend to myself in the state and in the condition I am in now? Let me end with this for tonight.